it isn't to worry about who's ahead or who's winning. And that's the way I always live my life. Not to be taken advantage of. That means not doing everything I want to do. We could actually... Now, this whole thing about religion, too, is and I love religion. You may have picked up on that. I really do. But you know, religion to the unrecovered mind like mine was a disaster, absolute disaster. What I heard were a lot of things I could beat people up with. And it says, we actually have earnest religious beliefs, which remain barren because we're still trying to play God ourselves. I knew what was best for other people. As long as we placed self-reliance first, a genuine reliance upon a higher power was out of the question. The basic ingredient of all humility, a desire to seek and do God's will, was missing. You know, that's the whole theme of our literature in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you read page 86, 87, 88, when they talk about the 11th step, they talk about how we will intuitively know, will come to realize how to handle situations that were difficult. And it's because we come to rely upon God. And it says we'll make mistakes, particularly in the beginning, we'll make a lot of mistakes. I remember I used to have all these wonderful ideas. They'd just come to me. It was like a burst of brilliance. And I'd write them down, and I'd take them to my friend Dick Corcoran. Dick's passed away now, but we were long, God, good friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's the one who taught me to read the big book again and to do a lot of things. And Dick and I'd be best friends, and I'd say, Dick, I got a great idea. He'd say, great, let's go to Chick-fil-A. We used to go to Chick-fil-A in the mall to break our diets when I had great ideas, and I'd sit there and I'd lay the idea, and I'll never forget. And Dick would—it was a very kind man—and he would just sit there and listen to me through the whole thing. I remember one time I had this idea. It was going to revolutionize something. I can't remember what it was, but it was a brilliant idea. And I ran it past him, and he's sitting there, and we looked, and this woman was walking by, and she was absolutely stunning, just a stunning woman. And she walked by, and we watched her walk by, and Dick turned to me and he said, well, there she is, God's will for me. And I knew exactly what he was getting at. You know, this brilliant idea of mine was the way the world would run if I were God. And what I hadn't asked was God's will in this deal. And whenever I'm off on these flights of fancy, I always leave God out of it. It was like my sponsor told me early on. He said, you're allowed to pray for something if it'll help other people. But you can't pray for stuff if it's just to help you. So I prayed to win the Irish sweepstakes so I could help other people. It says, a whole life geared to self-centeredness cannot be set in reverse all at once. Rebellion dogs every step. Rebellion is that part of us that says, I got a better idea. Well, how about me? Everywhere we saw failure and misery transformed by humility into priceless assets. We heard story after story of how humility had brought strength out of weakness. In every case, pain had been the admission into the new life. And, you know, when they talk about the character defects and the seven deadly sins in the 12 and 12, they always talk about pride heading the list. And a man challenged me. The man who heard my fifth step challenged me to find a character defect I had that pride was not involved. And I couldn't do it. Pride is involved with every character defect that I have. So the thing that I like to pray for is humility. To pray for humility. And God will give us humility. And it doesn't mean that we'll be humbled or embarrassed every time. It isn't. You know, you'll get an inkling of... I can tell you, one of the first things I did was I used to compete in a grocery store. I don't know if anybody ever does this, but you know, you got to pick the shortest line, and then, you know, you got to beat the old lady with the cart to that line, you know. And there's sort of... You don't want to appear as though you're racing the old lady, but... Because, I mean, that would look tacky, you know. That's not at all you know, that doesn't at all jive with the image I want to have, you know. But I want to beat that old lady. And you know, and one day I said to myself, I'm going to let her go first. And then one day later, I not only said, I'm going to let her go first, I said, I'm not going to let her know I did it. You know, because my first attempt was to run up there and then stop and say, you go first, madam. Because I'm that kind of guy. Real humility would act like I wasn't even thinking about leaving yet and letting her go first. Now, that doesn't cost anything. That doesn't cost anything. Yet those are practices. The nuns used to talk to us about practicing little things like that. Picking up a piece of paper because it's there. I do that. I see a piece of paper lying someplace, I pick it up and put it in a trash can. And I just said, well, it's not my paper. I didn't put it there. Why don't you get the guy who put it there? He's the one who ought to pick it up. But no, now what I try to do is just do that. I try to do things like that because those are the things that build character. And I try to do things when nobody's watching the way I would do them when they're watching. And that's what the seventh step is. The seventh step is to do things the way God would have me do them, even if I don't get found out. I love our friends in Al-Anon have that just for today. I love that. Today I'm going to do something nice for somebody and not let them know. And these are practices. I try to do things that my wife would do otherwise and not let her know about them. For example, you know, I'll like, you know, if I know she's going to change the bed or something, I'll change the bed. But she always catches me. She always says, honey, thank you for changing the bed. I said, that's all right. It's nothing. I'm just being spiritual. I just like to do things like that. And those are practicing principles. Those are things we learn. Well, you know, I practice selfishness. Why wouldn't I practice other things? I mean, I practice selfishness all the time. Why wouldn't I practice other things? And that's what the seven steps are all about. It's not finding that glaring defect of character and asking God to remove it. It's doing the little things, the very, very little things, the gentle things, the kind things. It's taking that extra second with the newcomer. You know the one who you don't want to talk to? You know the kind. Everybody's got a few of them around. And I take extra time, and I look at them, and I listen very intently to everything they have to say. And I remember that a guy remembered the names of my kids. I remember that. The guys remembered the names of my children. And that's why I'm alive today. See, I can't take a minute for some crazy newcomer. Of course I can. Of course I can. And the other thing I try to do is I try to be very, very considerate of newcomers. Because a lot of old-timers, a lot of people who have been around a while, like to dismiss newcomers as not having anything to say. Well, what could be crazier than that? They have a lot to say, and I need to hear it. No one told me to keep my mouth shut. One guy told me to shut up and take the cotton out of my ears and put it in my mouth, and I attacked him. I did. I'm not proud of this. I physically attacked a man in an AA meeting. I was sober 5 weeks. He had the wrong guy. That's all. He just picked the wrong guy. Very poor judgment. I had gone out to pick somebody up for a meeting, and we were coming back, and I cut in front of a guy, and he got mad and cut me off, and I went across the median and tried to run him off the road. I mean, I think it's a perfectly normal thing to do. So I'm with a woman who's smoking a cigarette, and she looked at me, she says, my, you're a reactor, aren't you? And I thought, what's with her? You know, I don't understand this. So we go to the meeting, and this guy, I won't tell you his name, he's dead now, but he used to do this all the time. He'd just insult people. He's just an insulting man. And I was saying, God, if there is a God, please don't let him say anything to me. And he got to me, and he said, you little so-and-so. He said, you ought to take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. You don't know nothing. And the next thing I knew, I'm strangling this guy on the table. It's a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm strangling this guy. And I just knew I was going to be evicted. And then a group applauded. So we were waiting for a long time for somebody crazy enough to come along and shut him up. We're glad it was you. Welcome. We're glad to have you. I try to remember that I didn't like being treated like that. He didn't like it much either, but I didn't like being treated like that. And I try to remember that with new folks. I try to remember the old timers in our program. I really try to remember them. I try to remember to thank them for what they've given me. They've given me everything I have. And I try to remember to thank them for that. And especially the ones that sometimes get too sick to come. And I like to remember to go see them or to call them up and see how they're doing and that sort of thing. It's all about being thoughtful. And that's what character building is all about. Character building is simply a matter of putting other people in front of me. It's accepting things the way they are, not the way I'd have them be. It's knowing that I have a small place. It's a place. It's mine. But it's just a small place in this scheme of things. My old sponsor, Sandy, used to tell me, I said, I don't feel as though I belong. He said, I know how you feel. He said, I could go to a strange city, and I could be standing on a corner, and someone would come up to me and say, excuse me, you're standing in my spot. And he said, I'd move. And he said, and then later I'd say, what does he mean, his spot? I got a right to that spot. You know, when I'd be home, I'd be carrying on about this stuff. But that's the way I felt about the world, that I didn't have a place and I didn't belong. And I do belong. And I believe that I belong when I do a decent job with the second step. That's what makes me fit in. That's what convinces me. I've been told my whole life I'm a child of God. The sixth and seventh step is what got me to really begin to believe that I was a child of God. I was becoming what He would have me be. And the book says that, doesn't it? It says what we don't ask God what we would do. We ask what He would have us be. What would He have me be? I think He'd have me be a kind, considerate, faithful, loving husband. That's what I think He'd have me be. I think He'd have me be a grateful employee, even if I didn't like what they were doing and how they were doing it. I think He would have me be a father, a good father. I think He would have me be a good sponsor. I think He would have me be a good pigeon, or baby, or sponsee, or whatever they're called, and I can't keep up with it. Guys, I sponsor pigeons. I was a pigeon. They're going to have to be a pigeon. It's just the way it is. But it's what would He have me be? I think He'd have me be kind. I can be caustic, and I can even use humor to cut you, but I don't think He would have me be that. I don't think He would have me appear to be funny at your expense. I don't think He would have me be a gossip. And I've done all these things, but one day I had to stop and say, I don't think that's what He would have me be. And the seventh step is the process whereby I come to realize that He can make me what He wants me to be, but I have to give Him access. The sixth step is recognizing I can't do it by myself, and the seventh step is a process of giving God the access to my life so He can do it. I was talking to a friend of mine earlier, and one of the things I try to do every day is I try to read spiritual material. I do some things, okay? One of the things I do, and I've done this my whole life, my mother had us do this. And when we were kids, my mother was a stickler for vocabulary. And she was a woman, an astounding woman. She never finished high school. And she was the best read person I've ever met in my life. She read everything. Read everything she laid her hands on. And her retention was amazing. After we all got through high school and most of us went to college and a bunch to graduate school and everything else, Mom goes to high school and gets her high school equivalency diploma. Then she takes her college entrance exams. She scored higher than any of us. And she said, well, why not? I've been through high school 11 times. And she had. She went through with all of us. And an extraordinary woman. But even as a child, we had to take turns. And we had to come up with a word that we didn't know. We'd find a word somewhere that we didn't know. And it didn't matter if other people knew it. What matters is that we didn't know it. And then we'd get a definition for the word, and we'd tell everybody, this is our word for the week, and we'd tell them, and we'd all write it down and write down a definition, and we'd use that word during the course of the week. And I remember one time I ran across the word gaggle. And so we wrote down gaggle and wrote down a definition and everything, And I hadn't used a word, and finally everybody's sitting around the table, and in my family, everybody talks at once. And I said to my mother, "What a gaggle of idiots we have here." And she said, "That's very good, son, that's very good indeed." So I still do that. I still run across the word, and I, you know, circle it, and I write it down, and I go find a definition, and I try to use it. Now, why? Well, I think that if I show up and I try to improve my skills, that God uses me better. My goal is to seek and to do God's will. And I think that curbing my bad language helps that. And I think increasing my vocabulary helps that. You know, when I was a little kid, I had a speech impediment. Nobody could understand anything I say. It's a great privilege for me to stand in front of intelligent people like you and speak. And I want to do as good a job as I can do. And so I try to improve my vocabulary to do that. It's not so anybody will think I'm smart. People know better. And none of that even matters, does it? None of that matters. My job is to carry the message. God saved my life to carry the message, and I want to improve that. The other thing I like to do is I want to read something spiritual every day. And the reason I want to read something spiritual every day isn't so I can become spiritual. That isn't what it's about. I believe that there's a spirit man in me. And that's the seventh step essentially tells me that's the man that can be strengthened. And when I came to you, I was so spiritually ill that the spirit inside of me suffered severe malnutrition. It was nearly dead. It was nearly dead. There was barely a spark alive inside of me. I was so dead that suicide seemed a logical option to me. And then I met you and things began to change in my life. And I began to wake up. And I used to think that I had to decide what I believed and didn't believe. You know, I mean, I had to decide, that makes sense, that doesn't make sense, that's right, that's wrong. And suddenly I realized that, you know, I'm a physical man. And like this morning, I ate breakfast and, you know, and I had bacon and eggs and a roll. Now, I didn't tell my body what to do with that. Well, here, bacon, you go to my eyes, and roll, you go to my waist. No, forget that. My body knows what to do with the food. I just put it in there. I don't tell it what to do. Why would I tell my spirit what to do with it? If I run it through my brain, there's no life left in it. Who was it? Byron, the great poet Byron, who said death by dissection. Somebody took one of his poems apart to try to understand it. And he said, it's a corpse. You've killed my poem by taking it apart. And he said, it's death by dissection. Am I supposed to dissect spiritual thoughts so I can understand? I kill them. What I do is I just put it in there. I read scripture. Read it every day. I put it in there. I read something from the big book of the 12 and 12 every day. Yesterday I read the story of the number three man, Bill D. Again, I love that story. You know, I play, you'll laugh at this, okay? You know the solitaire game in Windows, the Windows computer program, a solitaire game where you can put in the names of whoever you want. Every day I play a game of solitaire against Bill W., Dr. Bob, and Bill D. And I beat them like a drum. They don't have a chance. The hearts game. I'm sorry. The hearts game. Yeah. And, you know, we play hearts. And I play hearts against these three guys. And we play one game a day that I'm home and I'm on the computer and I beat them. And people will say, "Who's Bill D?" I say, "He's an old friend of mine." Bill D, he's an old buddy of mine. And Dr. Bob. So I play with these guys every day. But I also read what it is they have to say. And I read something every day. I don't dissect it. I just read it. And then my spirit uses it the way it's supposed to be used. You know, in the old days, the Hebrews, they were always told to meditate on the word. Just to meditate on the word. And that just means to consume it. Consume it. Because that's what drives our spirits. When I lived a life based on selfishness and self-centeredness and what's in it for me, and am I going to get ahead, and all the rest of it. When I lived a life like that, that drove me. That was my spiritual food. And it was a terrible way to live. And I don't want to live like that anymore. You know, I don't have to. And what I've discovered in the seventh step is I don't have to play. I just plain don't have to play. I was an officer in a corporation at one time, and a lot of the people there just plain didn't like me, and they were always doing these things to try to embarrass me or to show me up or this or that. It used to make them crazy because I wouldn't even pay any attention. You know, I wouldn't even pay any attention. I remember one time they used to have this deal where when the chairman of the board was there, the president and CEO was there, They were, and we're going to have a board meeting. They would always see how he dressed, and then they would dress like he dressed. If he took his jacket off and rolled up his shirt sleeves and loosened his tie, they'd all come in. The other officers would come in with their jackets off, their shirt sleeves rolled up, and their ties unloosened, you know. And so I one day saw all that going on, so I came in Bermuda shorts. And he said, at last, the guy who's showing some sense. Well, just make them crazy, you know, it's just driving crazy. And I came to realize that I used to live my life planning things like that. If I could make you look bad, I look good. And it's crazy, isn't it? And one day this guy came to me and he said, you know, there are people around here who don't like you, and it's because of your philosophy. And I said, yeah, I suppose so. And he said, it doesn't seem to bother you. And I said to him, I don't worry, because I said, I work for a rich Jewish man. He said, I'm not Jewish. I said, I was referring to God. And he said, oh. He said, that makes sense. He said, if you work for God, you really don't worry, do you? And I said, no. I said, I don't worry at all. I said, besides that, I said, you're talking to a guy who's supposed to be under a bridge someplace. And I said, I'm going to leave here and get my new Buick and drive home. And I may stop at the club and play a round of golf. And I said, that's a lot better than a bridge. I said, what am I going to worry about what a bunch of people think of me? And that's the freedom that comes in the seventh step. I was a guy who was so locked into needing affirmation and needing approval from everybody. Tell you, when I was back in college, okay? Now, I love my parents, and I wouldn't change anything about the way I grew up. But you know, when you grow up, you learn things. And so one of the things that, and I look back on it now, and it's funny now, but these are difficult things to learn. My parents could never congratulate you for what you did. And I remember, I'm sober, I'm back in school. One semester I carried 5 courses and I worked full time and I went to 7 meetings a week. And so I got 4 A's and a B. So here I'm 30 or 31 years old. I called my mother to tell her my grades. I said, Mom, I got my grades back. I got 4 A's and a B. Well, she said what she always said. That's nice, son. What'd you get the B in? You know? And I felt all this stuff I always felt. And finally, I realized it. You know, I went to my sponsor and I was laughing. I said, guess what? I told him. And he started laughing and he said, why are you going to school? He said, are you going to school to impress your mother? He said, you're a little beyond that, aren't you? He said, are you going to school because you enjoy the education? And I said, I enjoy the education. And he said, do you think you're the only one in the family that she does that to? I started laughing. I said, of course not. So I called my brother, Dumb Danny. You know, next day I called him. I said, hey, Danny. I said, how am I doing? He said, you're doing great. You got 4 A's and a B. He said, you're a lot smarter than me. She told me you're a lot smarter than I am. He said, how am I doing? I said, you're really doing well. You got another promotion. He said, well, great. So the joke was if we didn't want to know how we did, we called each other. Now, I understood those things, and once I understood what drove those things, the need that drove those things, and those are 6 and 7 step issues. Okay, my needing to suck from somebody or to pull from somebody or to extract something from somebody in order to go on. Once I understood those issues, it was then easy for me to live life. And I remember I ended up interviewed on a Today show for something, okay? And I knew I was going to be on the day before. I knew I was going to be on, so I'm on a Today show. And my brother Terry then, God bless him, was sleeping on a pool table in a bar. And he'd get up early and clean up the bar. That's why they let him sleep on the pool table until he had a little bladder problem, and they wouldn't let him sleep on the pool table anymore. But he's cleaning up the bar and saw me on TV, and he called my parents and said, Keith's on TV. And my father, who's used to the old life, said, my God, what has he done now? You know. And he said, no, he's on a Today show. They're going to talk to him on a Today show. Well, you know how they show you before they talk to you, so they show you, it's called something, you TV people may know that. But at any rate, so then they interviewed me. And my mother called later, and she said, son, we saw you on the Today show. She said, why didn't you tell us? And I thought, yeah, I didn't say it. Why didn't I? It didn't occur to me to do that. It was part of my job. It was part of my job. Now, this stuff is really, really important, because the things that drove my behavior and drive the way I live my life were based on character defects. Those things get changed. The result is that I'm not driven in life anymore. my goals become different. It's to know and to serve God, to carry His message and to do His will. And that has little to do with other people. I mean, I don't have to suck on other people to do that. I need other people. But I don't need from them what I used to need from them. And now this is it might be a little complicated. And I think it's a little bit, I know it's difficult for me conceptually. But I think this is critically important. And the seventh step is very, very, it's vital, I think, to my existence. Because the seventh step is the method and the mechanism whereby I begin a direct partnership with God. The third step, I ask God to take my will in my life, and then I clean myself up and all that stuff. But the seventh step is where I think I join in a partnership with God. I love old Hal M. from Washington, D.C., always talks about his partnership with God. And he said, God's a senior partner, and I'm the junior partner. He said, God's in charge of long-term planning, and I'm in charge of day-to-day operations. And he said that any time during the course of the day, I want to check and see how the day-to-day operations fit in with a long-term plan, I call on my senior partner and he helps me. And that really says it well to me, I think. I think the whole thing has to do with bringing on a new partner. And that's why the guys I sponsor, when it comes to the seven-step prayer, third-step prayer, I get on my knees with them when they pray. And I'm with them. And I usually say a little prayer for them before they pray. And then they pray the third step prayer. The seventh step prayer, I say, you go in there and you talk to God. Because this is with you and God. This isn't about me. This is where you're making a decision to join in to a relationship with God. And you're going to ask Him to take all your assets and all your liabilities and use them both. And that's a wonderful, wonderful contract. I know I spent a long time on 6 and 7. And the reason I have is because I just think it's critically important. I think 6 and 7, it's so easy to overlook. And yet, character building is what this is about. I could define, Bill recommended that when we do 12-step work, that we talk of, and Dr. Silkworth recommended this, that we talk about the progression of the illness. What he recommended we talk about, because it's in the progression of the illness that I recognize that I have this thing called alcoholism. Okay, it's in the deterioration of my life and the progression of the illness that I recognize it. It's not because I drink too much. I served in the Marine Corps with a lot of guys who drink too much. They drank too much on several occasions, but it didn't cost them. They didn't pay for it with their character. And their self-respect and all the rest of it. They got drunk and made a fool out of themselves from time to time. But it was different. My drinking was different than other people's drinking. You know the three guys that I joined with in Pittsburgh? The day I was discharged in 1965, all four of us were together again for the first time in 4 years. We had not run into one another at all during these 4 years. We were all four the same rank. And one had been in Okinawa and the other on the West Coast, and I'd been mostly on the East Coast in Europe and the Caribbean, and one was in the Air Wing in Iwakuni, Japan or something. And so we all met at dispersing. We were all discharged from Camp Lejeune. We all met at dispersing. We laughed, shook hands and stuff, and we were all getting out. And I said, let's go to the NCO club and have a sandwich. He said, that's a great idea. And we were all anxious to leave. We were just all anxious to get out of there. So we went over to the NCO club and we had a beer and a sandwich. And the three of them were still anxious to leave. And I said, what's the hurry? We've been here, we've been in this for 4 years. Let's have another beer. And they said, well, all right, one more, but then I'm getting out of here. My girlfriend's waiting or my parents are waiting or whatever it might be. And they had the next one and they left. And then I had another one and another one and another one. And I got home 10 days later. 10 days later. That's an alcoholic. Okay? That's an alcoholic. And I could see the progression of the illness. When I went in there, I meant to have one goodbye beer with these guys. And I got home 10 days later. They got home the same day. I mean, I remember, even actually remember some of the 10 days. I mean, I remember I was in Charleston, West Virginia, and I was drinking with a guy and four women, and it turned out that he was a pimp who was going to Moundsville State Penitentiary, and his girls were having a party for him before he went. He had to serve 2 years for soliciting prostitution, and they asked me to join them. And I mean, I'm a social guy, so I joined him. And then the next, and it's like pictures, it's like still frames, you know. The next thing I know, I'm driving this Cadillac convertible up in front of Moundsville State Penitentiary in Moundsville, West Virginia. And these girls are crying, and I'm crying, and we're saying goodbye to this guy and everything. And then the next thing I know, I'm back in Charleston, and I'm alone. And you know what was amazing about driving was I didn't know how to drive. I didn't have a driver's license or anything, but I was driving that pimpmobile from Charleston to... And Moundsville was only about 20 miles from where I was ultimately headed, and I end up back in Charleston. And finally I get home, and my parents are just crazy with worry. They had no idea what had happened to me. They knew I was getting out and coming home. And you know, all the balloons. My sister was a budding Al-Anon. She left the balloons with all the air out of them up just so I could see the decorations and the party that I missed. And all that stuff. I mean, it's just an insane, crazy way to live your life. And then that was the good part. And it got much, much worse than that. And the point of all that is that I could determine I was an alcoholic based upon the deterioration of my life. Well, I can determine whether or not the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are working for me based upon the appreciation of my life. I ask myself this question. Am I more the man I want to be this time this year than I was this time last year? And if the answer is no, I'm not doing it right. When I was in the throes of alcoholism, I could see through the 12 years I drank that every year I was worse than I was the year before. I was less the person I wanted to be. I may have looked more successful. I may have had more things hanging on my wall. I may have published more papers or whatever. But I was less the person I wanted to be than I'd been the year before. And the fantastic aspect of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a sober, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous is I can be more the person I want to be this time next year than I am this time this year. This time next year, I can be a better husband, a better friend, a better son, a better brother than I am this time this year. And that's the beauty of this. And that's the essence of the seventh step. The essence of the seventh step is improving. Become more and more the way God would have always wanted me to be. And that's when I experience His love. I experience His love in the forgiveness and everything, of course, but I really experience His love in our partnership, in our relationship. As I say in my 10th step at night, and my 11th step at night, when I do that, I say, boy, I did that the way you wanted me to do it today, didn't I? I didn't do it the way I did it before. I did it better today. Thank you. And I feel more and more akin to Him. Let me sort of introduce the eighth step, and then we'll take a break, okay? The eighth step, and I feel bad for you folks sitting. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Now, we know, of course, with the eighth step that this eighth step began with our fourth step. You know, there were a number of people listed on my fourth step. Okay, and that was the beginning of my eighth step. And the eighth step process is a very interesting one. And I want to tell you how I do it. The book isn't real specific about how to do it. It just says what we're supposed to do. So we make a list. And I remember Sandy said to me, he said, how you doing? How you come with your eighth step? I said, well, I said, I'm working on it. And he said, you got a list? I said, no. He said, then you're not working on it. So he said, because it said made a list. That's the first thing you do. So he took it, my yellow pad, my number two pencil that I can't lie, and he wrote list, L-I-S-T. He said, now start listing the people. And he said, start with the ones on your four steps. So I began to list people and stuff. Then he had me to do something very, very interesting. After I listed all the people, okay, he had me sit down with him and go through each one and explain to him why I thought I needed to make an amends to them. Okay, some of them were cut and dry. You know, I took stuff that belonged to them and made it mine. It's called stealing. And that's easy, you know. The Gulf Oil Company, I bought a battery and put it on my credit card and moved, and yet didn't give a forwarding address. Okay? That's easy. Dear Gulf Oil Company, in 1972, I bought a battery, fine battery, from your company. And I didn't, all this stuff, and I want to pay you for that battery, so I sent him the money. Right? So I get this nice letter back with a check. Dear Mr. Lewis, we're glad you enjoyed our battery, but, you know, that's been long written off, et cetera, et cetera. Would you please give that to a charity? And so I gave it to the charity, and I got a receipt and sent it back to the man who sent me the thing. And I said, I've done what you've done, and I said, in addition to that, for the next 2 years, I'm going to buy gas at your service station. Now, I left out the word overpriced gas at your service station. Because I thought it cost too much, but I did for the next 2 years. And he wrote back, sent me a credit card. So use this to buy gas at our station, you know. And so that stuff's easy. I mean, that stuff's easy, you know. That's really cut and dry. That's what I owe, you know. And I know why I owe it. I owe it because I took something along to somebody else. Simple. Very, very simple. Then there's the stuff that isn't so simple, like parents. Why do I owe my parents amends? Well, I mean, I disappear for 10 days. They're calling morgues in 3 or 4 states and hospitals and state troopers, and they're just sick with grief and worry. Is that why I owe them amends? Well, it might be, but might not be. That might just be part of it. That just might just be part of the behavior. The real damage I've done there might be very, very different than that. And when we talk about a ninth step, I'll show you how that was so. But what my sponsor had me do, and what I do with the guys I sponsor, is we got 3 by 5 cards. Okay? And each person, now we went through, we eliminated some people. You know, my ego had me, you know, owing amends to people that I hadn't done anything to. And it was my sense of importance. And so we eliminated some people. But most of them remained. It's not fair to say. I wasn't as mild and meek as I'd like to have considered. But we put each person or place or thing. I had God on there. I had the Catholic Church on there. I had everything that I was angry with, organizations, police, all kinds. I had it all on there. Okay. And I got a card for each one, and in the morning when I'd say my prayers or and this sort of thing, I just looked through those cards. And from time to time, a thought would hit me. And I remember, I'll tell you one, okay, there was a guy named Rich Moran, okay? And Rich was my best friend when I was a little kid. And the book says what? We go back as far as our minds can carry us. This isn't stuff I did drinking. This is stuff I did living a selfish, self-centered life. And Rich Moran and Tommy were two guys who were my heroes. Okay, when you're a kid, first your dad's the smartest guy in the world. Then one day he gets dumb, and the big guys are smart. The big guys are guys a year older than you. Well, Richard and Tom were big guys. They were a year older than us, and they joined us in the third year. They stayed back in the third grade. And I asked them why, and they said, well, we like your class better than the class we were in, so we asked the nun to keep us back. And, of course, big guys don't lie, so that was true. And I basically idolized these guys, okay? And I especially idolized Richie, and he was my ideal. He's a great athlete, and I wanted to be like that and everything. And we always were on the same team. Kids are funny. Little kids are funny. They always choose up teams. You know, you get the ball bat and you choose up teams. And the teams are always the same, but you got to choose them up. You either have to flip a coin, and you have the same captains. They always pick the same guys. And I was always on Richie's team. And he'd pick Tommy first, then he'd pick Richie. Well, we're in the fourth grade, and a new guy comes to town. Well, Richie's the kind of guy who would, he was a thoughtful, even as a kid, he was a thoughtful kid. And so he wanted to make the new guy feel welcome, so he picked him on his team. So I ended up on a wrong team, and I was crushed. And I mean, I was angry, and I was hurt, and everything. And so I had to punish the guy who picked me. I punished him by, I was in the end zone, he threw me a pass, and I just stood there and let it bounce off my chest. and I just looked at him. We could have won. We lost because I didn't catch that ball. Teach him. But the real guy who deserved punishment was Richie, because he's the one who really let me down by not choosing me to be on his team. And so I punished him by not talking to him. Now, is that a pattern that sounds familiar to you? I tell you, it's familiar to me. I gave everybody in my life one chance. And if they screwed up, they paid. And I talk to a lot of people like that. They'll say, I forgive, but I never forget. That means you never forgive, doesn't it? It means that you're giving people one chance. I knew he'd let me down if I gave him enough time. And that was sort of my slogan. So Richie had to be punished. And it really hurt his feelings. I mean, it really bothered him. And he came to me one day in recess. I stopped playing altogether. And he came to me one day and he said, "Boy, we really miss you on the team. We really miss you on the team." I didn't answer him. And he said, "I got an extra Twinkie." He said, you want it? I never met a kid who had an extra Twinkie before, but so he said, "I got an extra Twinkie. You want it?" And I said, "You don't want it?" He said, "No." I said, "You sure?" He said, "Yeah, I'm positive." I said, "You're positive?" He said, "You're honest, kid. I don't want it." So I threw it on the ground, stepped on it, and walked away. Wasn't I a nice little kid? So he's on my A-step list. Why? Because that's the way I treated everybody. I got a little more sophisticated than that. But that's basically the way I treated everybody who let me down or disappointed me. I was a real schmuck. And so we go to our 25th reunion. I'm engaged to Julia by this time. I go to my 25th high school reunion. First time I've seen Richie since high school. And so he's there. And I said, "I got to talk to you." And he said, "Oh, yeah, that'd be great. How you doing with talk?" He didn't look any different. Same guy, no, probably weighed the same. It made me sick. I said, "Went over." I said, "You know, you're going to think I'm crazy." I said, "But I'm a," I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, "Oh, one of my best friends is in AA." He said, "That's a great organization." And I said, "Well," I said, "one of the things we do is we make amends for damages that we've done." And I said, "And I really owe you an amends." He said, "What would you owe me an amends for?" He said, "We were best friends." He said, "I really missed you." And he said, "What would you owe me an amends for?" I said, "Well, remember when Bobby Harrington moved to town and you picked him on your team?" He said, "Yeah, yeah, you took my Twinkie and you threw it on the ground and you stepped on it." And I said, "I'd like you to buy a bag of Twinkies. I'd like to buy you some Twinkies." He said, no, it's all right, I'll tell you. Now, it's silly. It's silly. But you know, from then on, I haven't had to treat people like that. Those things change me. You know, those actions change me. Okay? But the key to it, of course, is to come to recognize why I owe the amends and how it fits together. One of the things that the man who heard my fifth step did for me, and what I try to do when I hear someone's fifth step, is he identified for me patterns in my life. My friend Bob Brown, who got sober with Maggie, said it well. Bob said, "You know, I used to think I had 20 relationships." He said, "In the fourth step, I discovered I had one relationship 20 different times." And what he meant was he repeated his patterns. He repeated his behavior. He repeated his behavior. He repeated his behavior. How many women I have known who always end up with a violent man? Wonder how that happened. They repeat their behavior, and they repeat their behavior, and they repeat their behavior. And I can't repeat my behavior and be different. So I got to find out what it is that I need to do, what it is I need to change. And that's the work of the eighth step. The eighth step is really, really an important one. It says, you know, we made a list of all persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. The obstacles, however, are very real. Then first and one of the most difficult has to do with forgiveness. You know, when it said became willing to make amends to them all, you know, the becoming willing is just that. It means forgiveness. You know, you'll often hear around AA, you'll often hear people say, if you want to make an A-step list, make a hit list. Make a list of people you'd like to punish. Make a list of people who owe you an amends, and that'll be your A-step list. And it's really true, because this isn't all one way. You know, the majority of the people on my A-step list were people I needed to forgive. because I had real issues with them, real or imagined. I imagined that they did things to me. Rich didn't pick me to be on his team. He wasn't conscious of my feelings. He hurt my feelings. He owed me. Well, of course, that's an easy one. You know, I'm an adult. I can look back and say, you know, when you're 10 or 11 years old, you think this way. Okay? What he did was the right thing. He welcomed a new guy into town by getting him on the team. That was the right thing to do. Okay? So it was easy to forgive that. But it's really difficult to forgive other things. Very, very difficult to forgive other things. And my amends will never work. It'll never happen if I don't completely forgive what others have done to me. And that's why making the amends at the right time is critically important. The book always says in the ninth step that timing is the key to this thing. Well, the timing is getting ready to do it and to do it properly. It didn't take any timing to make amends to Gulf Oil Corporation. Okay? But it sure made timing was important when it came to making amends to my ex-wife. Or when it came time to make amends to my children or to my brothers and my sisters and my parents and so many of the other people associated with my life. I had to forgive them everything. And once I did that, I had to understand why it was I owed them an amends. My brother Larry, who's a member of the fellowship and also lives in Wilmington, a wonderful young man, wonderful young man. I didn't know why I owed him an amends. And I went to make amends to him, and he told me why. And it was, I should have known. I mean, I look back on it, I thought I should have known this. Larry was born when I was 8 years old, and he was born almost on my birthday. It was a week after my birthday. And my parents always said that, Larry was your eighth birthday present. And Larry said, I got cheated. But I don't think I did. I love him. He's a wonderful man, and I wish you would know him. He's truly a wonderful, wonderful man. But he idolized me, and I didn't know that. And I go off to the service, and he idolized. He learned everything he could learn about the Marine Corps because I was there. And I remember him. He told me this story. He said I couldn't wait for you to come home. He said, I was sitting out on the porch one day, and Mom said, what are you doing, son? And he said, well, I'm waiting for Keith to come home. And she said, well, he isn't going to come home till tomorrow. He said, yeah, I know, but they might let him go home early. So he was waiting a day before I got home to see me. And he said to me, he said, I'll never forget it. He said, you got out of the cab, and he said, you had that big, heavy sea bag, and he said, you put it up on your shoulder like it was a feather. He said, I never saw anybody that strong before. And he said, you came up, and he told me the ribbons I wore and the badges that I was wearing. He knew what they meant. He'd gone to the library and studied it. He knew what they meant. And he said, I was so excited I wet my pants, and I was hoping you wouldn't see. And he said, you came by, and he said, I couldn't even talk. I was so excited. And he said, you rubbed my head and said, how you doing, kid? And he said, then you never spoke to me for the 2 weeks you were home. And I said to him, I didn't know I was important to you. And he said, I know. He said, he's an alcoholic too. And he said, I didn't know I was important to anybody either. And I said, if I had known how important I was, I would have spent every minute I could with you. And so now we spend every minute we can with each other. And I'm his big brother, and he comes and talks to me. And I'm always available to him. And he knows now to ask, but I'm always available to him. It's important for me to know why I owed him an amends. You know, being the oldest brother in a family like my family, an Irish family, is a very important position. A very important position. And with it comes real responsibilities. And I didn't see to those responsibilities. And because he was kind enough to give that information to me, I could then reassess my relationship with all my brothers and sisters, and I could begin to make the kinds of amends I really needed to make. My amends with my ex-wife, that's always a difficult one, you know, because the way we talked to each other was with lawyers and things.
and that's the way we hurt one another. And I was telling my, I told my sponsor, I said, I'll never be able to make amends to her. I said, we can't talk to one another that it doesn't deteriorate almost immediately into an argument and a disagreement. And he said, well, you have to keep praying. You just have to keep praying. And he said, and God will show you the way. I said, well, I will, but I don't see how it's going to work. And so one day I opened the mail and I got a letter from the IRS. You know, greetings, we miss you. Please call such and such a number. And so I called it. And a woman answered the phone, and she said, oh, yes, Mr. Lewis, I know. She said, I have your file right here. And we had an agreement when we were divorced that I would deduct Kelly on my income taxes, and Marilyn would deduct Kimberly on her income taxes. And so that's what we had done. We'd done that for some years. And one year she decided to change, and she deducted both of them. So of course the computer brought it up, and so they called me, and they said, if you'll send, they said, you know, I see in past years you each deducted one of the children, and if you'll send me the divorce agreement, I'll bill her. And I said, I don't want to do that. I said, bill me. And she said, but you made more money, and you'll get. I said, no. I said, I really mean this. I said, I want you to bill me. I said, I am really grateful for this opportunity. And she said, Mr. Lewis, this is the strangest call I've ever made. And so I said, well, I figured, what the heck? So I said to him, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I put that woman through all kinds of hell. I said, I can't tell you how difficult her life was because she was married to me. And I said, I've been looking for ways to make amends to her, because that's what we do. We try to fix what we've broken. I said, I've been looking for ways to make amends. And I said, I was just praying for the last couple of weeks for an opportunity, and you gave it to me. And I said, I'm really grateful for that. And she said, this is the strangest call. Then, of course, she had a friend. She had to tell me about her friend who drank too much. And so I recommended that she take her friend to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, if your friend doesn't want to go, you go. Because, you know, we can tell. And, and you know, it's an interesting thing. The next time, I never mentioned it to my ex-wife. She's never mentioned it to me. The next time we talked, we didn't argue. And that has been 20-some years, and we haven't argued since. Whatever it was, it took it out of it. It just wasn't important anymore. Little thing. Little thing. Now, I've continued to make amends, and I continue to make amends as long as they raise the children. I had some difficult times with some of this stuff, too, but with my sponsor, I was able to do things that I didn't think I'd ever be able to do. And I don't know if they were proper or not. They seemed to be indicated at the time. My sponsor explained to me early on about child support and how important it was. And I always paid it, but I paid it because I didn't want to go to jail, or I didn't want people to think ill of me. That's why I paid it. And we talked about motives, and he said, you know, you have a moral responsibility to support your children. And I said, I know I do. You're right, I do. And so he said, I want you to send that check first. Write that check first. I said, well, I got to write them all. I said, it doesn't matter. He said, very important you write that check first. And then you thank God for the ability to support your children. So part of the amends was to write that check first and to thank God. And one day I look forward to it. Look forward to writing the check. And my ex-wife met a guy. I liked him a lot, so which diagnosed him immediately. I won't tell you what disease he has, but I really liked him, and she called me up, and it was really kind of her. She said, I don't think that, you know, I don't, you know, believe this is going to be a shocking news to you, she said, but she said, I wanted you to hear from me, and she said, I'm going to marry again. And I said, well, I think that's wonderful. And I know it's been a hard road, and I said, I really think it's wonderful. I said, tell me about him. And she said, well, he's a surgeon I met in the hospital, and he's in all this, and real nice. And she said, he has two boys, and I have two girls. And she said, so it should be interesting. And I said, how are the girls taking it? And she said, well, I don't know. And I said, how would it be if he and I take them to dinner? And then I can get to know him, and they can learn that it's okay to like both of us. And she said, would you do that? I said, of course I would. She said, what's my goal? My goal is to to amend the damage I've done. And so Jeff and I took the kids to dinner, and he really is a nice guy. I mean, I really like him a lot. And the kids saw it was okay to like both of us, and they didn't have to make choices. And Jeff said in front of them, he said, you know, we're going to be buying a house and everything, and the house belongs to the girls too, and you're welcome there anytime they want to see you. And so the girls didn't have to carry that around with them. And that's part of how you make amends. You know, amend is making it easy on the people that you love. Okay? And if it means giving something up, you give it up. You know, one day, some years later, this man called me. And a couple of years later, he called me, had a partner who was in a lot of trouble, and he said, he'd be willing to talk to somebody. Would you come and talk to him? And I went, and I 12-stepped his partner, and his partner got sober. And then he called me another time after I had moved to North Carolina, and he called me up and he said, I have a problem. And I said, what is it? He said my wife gets upset if your check is a day late, and she's happy if it's a day early. And he said, frankly, I'm tired of you living in my house. And I said, well, I can really understand that. He said, is there any way I can talk you into not sending anything? And I said, no. I said, you know, I have a moral obligation to support my children. And he said, I knew you'd say that. And he said, I make more before breakfast than you send. I said, well, I know you do. And I said, I'm really glad for you and for them and everybody. But I said, that doesn't negate my responsibility. And he said, would you think about it? So I thought about it, and I called him back a couple of days later, and I said, I figured out how much child support I would pay if I paid until they're 18. I said, how would it be if I give you that amount of money and you invest it for them? And in that way, I will have supported the children, and my check wouldn't be coming into your house every month. And he said, would you do that? I said, of course I would. And that's what we worked out. So that's how they went to Auburn and Duquesne and that stuff. I mean, life gets simple when I'm not the most important thing in it. And that's what the amends signify. The A step convinces me that I'm not the most important person in these people's lives. I've been destructive in their life, and it would be thoughtless of me to not know that. The book says is that, you know, it's like the man who, after the hurricane, begins to say that good thing the wind stopped blowing. Yeah. Why don't we take a break? Okay. Perhaps we could get started again. Yeah. No, we're on steps 8 and 9, and in the 12 and 12 it says that whenever our pencil falters making the A step list, we can fortify and cheer ourselves by remembering what AA experiences in this step has meant to others. It is the beginning of the end of isolation from our fellows and from God. That's quite a promise for a guy who lived a horribly isolated life. Step 9, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And I like that first sentence. It said, good judgment, a careful sense of timing, courage and prudence. These are the qualities we shall need when we take step 9. I was really taken with this step in the very beginning. I was, living in the basement of a house in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. And I was alone, and I was frightened, and I was financially devastated. And so I called up my estranged wife and asked her if I could talk to her, and she came over, and I got this book out, and I showed her the 9th step, and I explained it to her, and I said, so I've asked you to come over here so I can make direct amends for the damage I've done to you. And she said, well, I think that's wonderful, Keith. She said, it's an admirable quality. And she said, I'll have my lawyer get up with your lawyer and arrange something. And I called her all the names I called her before, and my sponsor shared with me that that's the 9th step for a reason, and it really isn't there to manipulate the people in our lives. It's really there to fix the damage that had been done in the past. So that's why a few years later I needed the IRS to help straighten my life out, and it's got to be a first. absolutely got to be a first. Quite a variety of things on this list, and because it's very specific, and it's important that we include people, places, things, institutions, etc. And I'll tell you, one of the great gifts of the ninth step came to me as a result of my recognition of the fact that I was very quick to criticize religious or spiritual people, very quick to criticize them, to call them narrow-minded, to do a lot of things. And I, of course, I realized in my fourth and fifth step that what I did was I feared them, because they appeared to be doing a lot better with life than I was doing. They appeared to be living their lives in the way I would have wanted to live my life, and in the way I imagined one day I would live my life. And so I ended up resenting them very much. And I never missed an opportunity to say something hurtful or critical of them, either to their face, preferably, or at least behind their back. And I know that this was a serious matter, so I put down religious people on my A-step list, and I prayed about it, and I talked to my sponsor. And I went to my sponsor before I made every amends, with a few exceptions. Sometimes it's so clear and so obvious that action needs to be taken, I took it. But this one, I talked to him about it, and I said, I'd like to go down to a retreat center, and I'd like to talk to one of the retreat masters, either one of the nuns or one of the priests down there. And he said, I think that's a very good idea. So one day I drove down, and I got down there, and I recognized, I saw him, and it was a professor I had. He was a young, hep theologian and priest, and I knew he'd understand the significance of this terribly humble act I was about to perform. And you know, I could never get to him. It was the strangest thing. I could never get to him. And I'm wandering around this retreat center, and I kept walking by this room, and there was an old guy in this room, and he was sitting in a rocking chair. It was an old priest, and he was reading a breviary, his office. And he had a blanket over his lap, and he was rocking and reading. And it occurred to me that I was supposed to talk to him. Finally, it occurred to me. And I knocked on the door, and he said, I said, Father, may I have a few moments of your time? He said, of course, son, come in. And he dragged a rocking chair over opposite his, and he and I sat and talked, and we rocked. And I told him why I was there. I told him I was there to make amends to religious people, and how critical I'd been, and how far off base I'd been, and how sorry I was for that, and how I really envied them. And then he said, tell me a little bit about yourself. And so I began to tell him a little bit of my story. And he listened to me, and he had an expression on his face I could best describe as awe. And he finally stopped me, and he said, stop. And he got up, and he's an old man, and you know, he's sort of shaky, and he pulled me up, and he began to hug me and pat me, and he began to cry. And he said to me, God sent you. I said, excuse me? He said, God sent you. He said, I've been a priest for 50 years. And he said, I have an illness that is soon going to allow me to go home. And he said, I've just been asking my higher power where I've missed it. You know, where have I not served you the way I wanted to serve you? And he said, it occurred to me that many times during my ministry, he said, I've stayed with the people who agreed with me and the people I was comfortable with, and I forgot what I was told to do, and that is to go out and find the one who was lost. And he began to cry. And he said, I'm sorry you were out there all alone. And I was overwhelmed. And we talked for quite a while about things, and we ended up laughing and joking about things. But driving back, it occurred to me, I think for the very first time, that this isn't a selfish program. You hear that a lot, and I used to believe that. But it's not a selfish program. I believe it's a selfish... I did incalculable damage to the people around me when I was drinking and getting spiritually sicker and sicker. And I really believe that I can do good around me as I work this program and make amends. And his name was Jim, and he lived another 6 or 8 months or something like that, and he did go home. But before he went home, he was able to make amends for the damage that he had done. And, you know, and what amazed me was, here was a man who did most of what he was supposed to do for 50 years. And he was concerned about what he had not done. And here I am, who'd screwed around his whole life, and I'm just starting to try to make beginnings at doing what's right, and I was able to go help him. It's an amazing life we lead and live. You know, I had my mother on the amends list, and moms are moms, you know, and moms are quicker to forgive than anybody in the world, I think. It's just amazing to me. And I didn't understand my mom. I know that she used to drive me crazy, and she'd tell those stories that would embarrass you and all that stuff, and it used to irritate me. And you know, it came time, and I made amends to mom, and it was shortly after that that I got my very first token or chip, and it was a 4-year chip. I had decided with my sponsor that I was going to spend a few years being the kind of son that I should have been, calling her weekly, asking how they're doing, being interested in what's going on in their life, going to visit them fairly regularly, allowing her to tell those dumb stories and smiling instead of telling her to stop. You know, I was going to act like a decent son for a while, and then I was going to make direct amends verbally. And she was up in Washington, and I went, and like I say, they didn't have chips when I got sober, and so it was like 4 years later, and I got my first chip, and we were driving home, and she said, "You know, son," she said, you said once that if you could do anything, if there's anything I wanted to let you know," she said, "I'd sure like to have one of those coins." So I gave her my 4-year chip, and she said, "Oh, I don't want this one." I said, "No, that's the one I want you to have." I said, "That's the first one I've ever had, and I want you to have that." I said, "I can get another." And every year on May the 13th, I'd send she and my father a chip. And then they would send me a card telling me how proud they were of me. And I really got to know what Alcoholics Anonymous meant to her. She contracted cancer a few years ago, and she had a very slow and painful and beautiful death. It sounds incongruent, but it's not. My mother is one of those people who believe that suffering was something that could be used, and she offered all her suffering up for the salvation and the welfare of her 11 children, then 10, because her son Terry had already passed away from this illness. And I got a glimpse of what Alcoholics Anonymous meant to her, and the fact that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what had happened to our relationship over the years while she was dying. I had gone up to spend some time with her. My brother Larry, who lives in Wilmington, went with me, and we were just sitting by her bedside, and she's a great lover of prayer, and at night I would sit with her, and I would pray the rosary aloud, and she would wake up from time to time and pray with me, and then go back to sleep. And this one evening, Larry and I were with her, and my niece came in, and my niece was pretty new to AA then, and she was all excited, and she said, "Oh, Uncle Keith, Uncle Larry, you have to come to the meeting tonight. My sponsor Barbara's speaking, and she's wonderful." And I said, "You know, I'd love to hear Barbara." I said, "But I thought I'd spend this evening with Mom. But we'll hear her another time." And my mother said, "No." She said, "You boys come here." So we went over by the bed, and she said, "You must go to that meeting." And she grabbed my hand, and she said, "You must promise me to always go to those meetings." She said, "Those were the people who brought my sons home to me." And I was really got an appreciation for what it must have been like to watch what happened to me and what happened to my brother Larry, and then to watch us come back. I had a great appreciation for what it must have meant to her. And you know, she died well. My sisters, who were so good and took such good care of her, put all the pictures of all the children. They have 11 children and 20 grandchildren and 20-some great-grandchildren, and put all the pictures on the wall, and all the daughters-in-laws and son-in-laws and outlaws and everybody else in the family. Just put them on a wall, and she would just look at them and smile and go to sleep and wake up. And her last great-grandbaby was about a month old, and she held her, and I have a picture of her holding her last great-grandbaby. And she said, they just get more beautiful, don't they? And she listed the things that she wanted in her coffin. And at the very top of the list was my 23-year chip, the very first thing. So I got some sense of what Alcoholics Anonymous meant to my mom, and more importantly, some sense of what my life in Alcoholics Anonymous meant to my mom. Not just that her son was alive and reasonably well, but what it meant to her, peripherally. I mean, she suffered peripherally as a result of my alcoholism. And, you know, she and my dad had never been on a vacation. And you don't do that when you have 11 children. They didn't even have an automobile. And I had a beach house, and they had never seen the ocean. And so we brought him to North Carolina, and Dad stood on the deck with my brother Larry. He was watching the ocean, and the waves were crashing and crashing, and he turned to Larry after a little bit, and he said, do they keep doing that? And Larry said, as long as I've been watching, they have, Dad, you know. And I took Mom, and she just would sit out there at night. She and my dad would sit out on a swing, and he put his arm around her, and they'd watch the... They'd watch the night come and watch the stars come out. And I asked them, I was moving from North Carolina to Alabama, and I said, I'm really worried about the beach house. I really was worried, right? And I said, I wish I had someone to keep an eye on it for me. And Dad said, well, we're not too busy, so... so they moved to North Carolina, and they lived in a beach house, and they vacationed for 6 years, and... It was wonderful, and I'd stop by and see them and just had the best time. And then they moved back to Ohio shortly before other things began to happen. But I named the beach house. I had a sign made and put on it, and the sign was CZ Does It. And everybody who knew. So people would stop by constantly, and they'd knock on a door, and they'd say, excuse me, ma'am, are you a friend of Bill Wilson? She'd say, no, but my son's a good friend of Bill Wilson's. And she'd bring him in, and they'd have iced tea. I met people from all over the country who said, I had iced tea with your mom and your dad down at CC Does It. And it was just an amazing thing, the way they lived their lives. I mean, the beauty and the simplicity, the love that they shared with 50-some years of marriage is just an incredible thing to watch. And my mother is... I'm so glad I got to know her and love her the way she was as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, and not what I imagined. They were taking her in for surgery one time, and so they had shot her up with dope, you know, so she was flying high. And one of the things we had to do before every meal was we had to listen to some rule for grammar or something like that, you know. And so we're all gathered around, they're ready to wheel her into surgery. The doctor's there, the anesthesiologist there, they're all standing there. And my mother said, just a minute. And she leaned up and she said, remember, boys, never, never, never end a sentence with a preposition. And the surgeon said, what the hell is that all about? I said, well, we're going to go get a bite to eat. Mom always gives us a rule of grammar before we go get a bite to eat. Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful way to live. And to have gotten close to that and to see the beauty in that and to come to understand where her fear came from and how she was driven and how she matter-of-factly sat down one day when I loved her well enough that she could trust it, that I wouldn't ridicule her or laugh at her. She sat down and she told me about what it was like in her life. And she said, you know, I know you loved your granny. And she said, your granny should be loved. She was a wonderful woman in a lot of ways. She said, you know, but when she drank. And my mother was an illegitimate child, and she didn't have a birth certificate or anything. And she always felt like she didn't belong. And granny was a periodic alcoholic. And when granny wasn't drinking, she was the kindest, most loved woman in the world. When she began to drink, she was a maniac. The only thing that stopped her, she either went to the hospital or she went to jail. And that's how this little Irish woman stopped. The last time she went to court, she was 73 years old for assaulting a 35-year-old man with a bar stool and broke his arm. And you know why? It was St. Patrick's Day, and he had an Irish name, and he was an African-American, and that was a reason enough for her to attack him. She's crazy. But Mom began to tell me what it was like to be a little kid, and she said it matter-of-factly, and that's what struck me. She said, you know, when Mother was out drinking, said, you know, she never came home alone. And she said, I would live in terror for when she'd come home. She said, so what she'd do is take a hammer and nails and wrap them up in a blanket and put them under her mattress. And then when Mother came home, she'd come with somebody, and my mother was like 12 years old or 13 years old. And she said, after Mother passed out, they would come looking for me. And she'd talk about how she would crawl out on the stoop porch and nail the window shut so they couldn't get to her. Now, I began to understand how this woman hung on to everything, how she constantly had to be affirmed and that she was belonged and that we loved her and she was doing a good job as a mother. She'd constantly say, I feel like such a failure. I used to say, how can you be? How can you be a failure? And so I was able to make amends, one, by making a direct amends, but two, like it says in the book, by living the life of a sober son. And not just a sober son, but a sober son who understood. Somewhere along the line with our parents, something happens, and we begin to take care of them. And if I've loved them well, they let me do that. I think that, you know, my relationship with my mom was one that was very, very profound, but you know, the one that I think is the key to most of my relationships is my relationship with my father. And I think that's true for men. I don't know about women. But I believe that all men have to get it straight with dad before they do well in the world, period. It's just my belief. And I've come to this with the guys I work with, and my sponsor and I have talked it over, and he agrees with me. And one of the hardest ones was my dad. My dad was a non-demonstrative guy, and I was sure that if he ever told me that all he had to do was tell me that he loved me, if he told me he loved me, I knew I'd be okay. And I carried that for the longest kind of time, and then all of a sudden, I got sober, and it was time to make amends. And I had a little 3x5 card, and I'd pray about it, and things would occur to me, and I'd write them down, and that sort of thing. And I told my sponsor, I think I'm ready, and I drove from Washington to Ohio, and I'd come in and I'd sit down and I'd be in my dad's presence. I'd get a cup of coffee. I'd be in his presence for half an hour. I'd get so angry that I couldn't stand it. And I'd get up and drive back to Washington. That happened, and I said to my sponsor, it's never going to work. And he said, no, I think you're close. I think you're probably just a few prayers away. I think you're that close, he'd say, you know. And I said, it's never going to work. I can't talk to that man and everything. And I did it again. I drove back up there. I stayed about an hour, and I got in a car and drove back. And finally, he said to my mother, he said, you know, I like that boy, but I worry about him. He said, he goes a long way for a cup of coffee. Completely unaware of what's going on with people emotionally. And finally, he was down at Beach House, and I stopped down to see him. And I was being successful. I was an officer with this corporation. I was doing all the things, and I was miserable. And I'm a guy who's got to work with people. I can build buildings. I build a lot of them, and I can put together deals. I put together a lot of deals, and I'm good at it. But it's not what God wants me to do. But it's what I thought I was supposed to do. It was the next promotion, and I thought that's what I was supposed to do. And I was miserable, and I didn't know what to do, and I had sort of drifted away from my sponsor. I hadn't yet gotten my next sponsor, and I talked to some guys in AA, but